This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte on this Thursday and this Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Let's check in with the first of our series of reporters on the stories that they have covered in print as well as online. First, we have Doug Ross, who's the senior reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana with us. Doug, as always, thanks for joining us.
Oh, glad to be here.
We have a couple stories that you have, one more extensive than the other. The one that was featured over the weekend was a longer story in more detail talking about the impact that Lake and, in particular, Lake and St. Joseph counties are going to be facing because the amount of debt that they're holding and what kind of impact that the property tax caps is going to really have an impact on financially for these two counties. And you had a lot of time to have a chance to talk with some people here in Northwest Indiana about the impact of the property tax caps. We have alluded to the upcoming property tax caps in 2020 in the conversation we had with the superintendent of the Lake Ridge New Tech School Corporation, because the Lake Ridge schools will have on some of the ballots in their area a request asking for more funds through referenda to be able to cover the costs of running the school district and improving the schools in the school district when the property tax caps kick in. Remind us, because I'm sure none of us seem to remember, that there's going to be changes made come 2020 in how much property taxes will be assessed because of these taxes. We've already gone through one round of tax caps we're under right now, but there's going to be another one going in effect in 2020, right?
Well, sort of. Mm-hmm. Here's the way it works. And let me start with the referendum that you just mentioned,
right,
with Lake Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
The school corporations have these referendums, and something that voters will want to know, and taxpayers sure want to know, is that when they do a referendum like this, then that money, that extra money that they're getting for successful referendums, that's outside the tax cap.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And so here's where it gets complicated. If it wasn't enough already, is that for Lake and St. Joseph County, they had so much heavy debt, primarily from the school corporations building new schools and whatnot. Hammond went on a building spree for elementary schools, for example. A lot of school districts did this. And then, 2008, it was time to kick in the tax caps. 2008, if I remember, 2012. I'll have to double check that. But but in any case, the tax caps legislation passed, and Lake and St. Joseph counties had debt that was incurred prior to that day. So it was July 1st of that year. Any debt incurred prior to that was exempted from the tax cap. Now that's all 90 other counties, that wasn't the case, but just those two counties, because there was so much long-term debt that the legislators were really, frankly, concerned that they wanted to make sure that enough money was generated to be able to pay those debts. So if you have a mortgage, you understand this, after so many years, you pay it off, right? And so that's basically, what they were thinking was, okay, in 2020, it won't be as much of a hardship because a lot of these will be paid off. And so the problem is a lot of them still won't be paid off. Now, Michael Griffin was testifying before the Interim Study Committee on Fiscal Policy, which you probably never heard of. But in any case, this is a legislative study committee that's looking at financial issues and a couple that affected Lake County in particular, this being one of them. And so what Michael Griffin was saying, he's a Highland Clerk Treasurer, is that in 2020, local governments in Lake County alone is going to lose about $42 million more in revenue because of the tax caps will no longer exempt this long-term debt. And what that means is, the debt still has to be paid. And so here's kind of the way he was explaining it. If you figure that your tax bill is reduced, say 5% because of the tax cap, then that 5% would ordinarily apply, across the board to all funds. But because debt service has to, your debts have to be paid first, then what that really is that hitting the operating expenses that would apply to, you know, say, paying police officers, operating your parks, things like that. And so it's going to be, you know, if it's 5% across the board, then it's really 10% of the operating funds, because the 5% that would normally hit the debt service would have to go to the operating fund, you know, the general fund in this case. Mm-hmm. And so so they're really, frankly, worried about this and, you know, hoping that it can be extended. Ingrid Norris is the director of the Lake County Public Library. She was there, too, and saying, you know, hey, we've been trying to pay for this. We've, like, cut our costs by, I think, $400,000, if I remember she was talking about. And reduce the staff from somewhere around 240 to just over 200 employees. But on that deadline, you know, when January 1st of 2020 rolls around, bam, that could be, you know, a $800,000 hit.
That's right. I know that in your story, you mentioned in what Michael Griffin had mentioned to the study committee, that he's outlined what at least the town of Highland has done in the hopes of trying to beat the impact of the tax caps being exempted, the exemption going away, I should say, that he talked about user fees. And he went, into more detail about how the town of Highland has been able to deal with it. And we know, of course, other communities use user fees. Do you think that with the testimony that more counties are going to have to add more user fees than what they have now?
Oh, absolutely. The question is, you know, how much can you legitimately charge for a certain thing? A lot of governments actually use a lot of user fees right now. I'm going to use Porter County as an example. County government, the planning and stormwater department, that is entirely supported by user fees. So, you know, if you want to build a new subdivision, if you want to build a storage barn in your backyard, all of that, you know, you have to pay fees that cover, the cost of operating that department. So, when the economy, really tanked during the Great Recession, well, you know, that department had to cut back on its employees because, you know, they weren't generating the revenue. They didn't have the demand, so they had to cut back. So, you know, that's the sort of thing that you can see. The funny thing is, with government, in a lot of cases, where the economy goes bad, that's where the demand for services increases. So, you know, if you're talking like, you know, food stamps or you know, any kind of poor relief, really, frankly, that's when the revenue drops. So it's kind of a catch-22 for government. You know, how do you figure out, you know, we need the money, but we got to salt it aside and all of that. And, you know, Highland is talking user fees for one of the examples was, you know, say you need to be fingerprinted for your employer as opposed to being arrested or something. If it's for a personal reason like that, then you're going to be charged for it. If you're even just going to a police station to, you know, hand off custody of a child where the parents are divorced or whatever, then you're going to be charged for that. You know, something as simple as, you know, just having a police officer stand by and really, frankly, do nothing but be there just in case, you're going to get charged for it. And so, you know, who knows what other kind of fees they'd come up with.
We may see that in the time here between now and 2020. We have a little bit of time, not very much, but you know, less than 2 years. And by the time those the exemptions disappear, we may see a lot more user fees established out there by all governments and whatever, and besides police departments for various services that they currently do for free right now. To be sure, you talk about poor relief, and that kind of leads into our next conversation here, and one of the other stories that you have out. It's the update on what the community of Griffith is getting ready for. They have, of course, residents in Griffith have voted to secede from Calumet Township. Poor relief expenses from Calumet Township have been one of the things that residents in Griffith have groused the most about. Over time, they've claimed that they've paid a lot of money to Calumet Township and have gotten few services back than they should have for the money that they've paid. And that is why residents opted to secede from Calumet Township, and now they're making a choice between North Township and St. John Townships. That was the latest discussion I know that came up at town council, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And so this is, and you're right, they were putting in like $2 million a year into Calumet Township and getting back, you know, about $150,000 in services. Well, you know, as a return on investment, sooner or later you're going to stop investing on that. And that's exactly what the voters did. So now what they're trying to do is, you know, the town is eligible to join either, or to be annexed by, I should say, either North Township or St. John Township. It's got to be, you know, you've got to have contiguous, meaning, you know, connecting borders there. And so because they have kind of a tough question. You know, North Township does amazing stuff. Frank Mervan gets a lot of praise as township trustee, because he's addressed so many things, you know, the No More Secrets campaign, you know, before Me Too really even became as popular as it is now, dealing with sexual assault and all of this, and that issue, the township, you know, saw a need to try to protect women and children primarily, but men as well, from sexual assault, and, you know, how to get them to speak up when this has happened to them, so that, you know, their attacker can be confronted and so forth, and you know, all of these issues. So they've dealt with that. He's dealt with veterans housing. The township offers the Dial-A-Ride service, you know, for senior citizens and stuff.
Yeah, I was going to mention that's been a very, very popular feature that North Township has been able to offer, and the township residents are paying for that. But it's a benefit that has really paid off for the township, I know.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, can you imagine, you know, a buck and then you get a ride? You know, that's a service that's amazing. I guess it's free now. Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, it takes taxes to operate these things. And so North Township's tax rate is a little more than the tax rate in St. John Township, which, you know, frankly, doesn't offer all those. So the question is, you know, how much do we want to pay for services, you know, what's the value to it, and do we want fewer services and not pay more? Do we want more services and pay a little more than we would otherwise, but still a heck of a lot less than if the town were a part of Calumet Township? I mean, you know, here's where it goes into perspective. So Calumet Township has a tax rate that's 4.35 times that of North Township. But St. John Township, Calumet Township's tax rate was more than 31 times that of St. John Township. I mean, you know, so those are some numbers that'll, you know, make you sit back and think. That's going to be tough.
Yeah, they have a pretty tough decision to make there. They can opt for one where they'll pay less, I guess, as a community in taxes if they go into St. John Township, and then they'll have to pay more technically for a North Township membership, I guess, or annexation, however you want to put it. But they'll get more services. So I suppose they have to make the decision between the two, and they're up against the deadline too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, keep in mind that they're still paying a heck of a lot less for North Township than they would for Calumet Township. So, yeah, you know, they're saving money either way.
Yeah. Now, they're up against the deadline. Of course, we know that the voters in the special referenda had chosen to opt out of Calumet Township. And I know that the community of Griffith, or at least the town council, wants to get this done very soon.
Yeah, so here's how that's going to work. They've got... they want to wait until after the election, frankly. So shortly after November, I think there's actually even a town council meeting currently scheduled for November 6th. But I don't know if they'll postpone it because of the election or not. But they want to decide pretty quickly which direction they want to go. So they have a couple of choices. They can say, you know, we want to be annexed by St. John Township. And then the St. John Township Board would have to vote to approve that. And then if that happens, it goes forward. Or they could do the same thing for North Township. Or they could say, we'll take whichever one takes us first, and then whichever township board acts first, you know, cast the first vote, then that's the one they go with. So they want to conclude the deal, I mean, actually have this finished, all the paperwork, not just, you know, saying, yes, we'll do it, but have all the paperwork finished by the end of the year. And here's where it gets complicated. It's because in the year before a census, meaning 2020, you're not able to transfer to a new township. And so they want to get this done so that they're a part of the new township and not, you know, still, you know, paying their tithes to Calumet Township until they can actually get the transfer concluded. Mm-hmm. So that's why they want to act, you know, shortly after November 6th and see how fast they can get this done so that they don't have to wait a couple of years.
And I imagine, too, that when you think about this altogether, we have that to the next logical question, I guess, and that's probably the basis for another story or series of stories, I'm sure, that'll probably come out, is what kind of impact all of this is going to have on Calumet Township. We know that Calumet Township is primarily made up of the city of Gary. And we know that what the funding is going to help for, as we mentioned, poor relief, I mean, in large part. And what kind of impact is it going to happen for with the loss of that revenue that they would have gotten from Griffith, I suppose. So more great stories to come out soon, I'm sure, Doug, and something to follow through on the next time we talk, I'm sure. Thanks.
Yeah, probably.
Thanks for being with us today. Doug Ross is senior reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And we, as always, appreciate you spending time with us here on Regionally Speaking.
Oh, well, thank you, Chris.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. Let's check in with Greg Tejeda, who covers mostly news for the city of Gary for the Post-Tribune. And as always, Greg, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, some of the major stories that you have had on deal, of course, with the city of Gary, and the first one in particular, one of the later stories, talks about the Common Council meeting that dealt with the budget here. And I guess the council did approve five ordinances. And maybe the question comes down for somebody who doesn't cover city government and know much about how city government works. Why are there five ordinances that, when you put them all together, turn out to be a budget, in this case for 2019?
One ordinance is for the actual programs that various city agencies operate. A second ordinance is for the salaries of city employees. Two other ordinances are for the maintenance and for the salaries for the airport. And then a fifth ordinance is for the Gary Public Transportation Corporation.
I guess because these are all different separate parts of city government that all get put together, yeah.
In the case of the airport and the bus company, their boards actually approve, set their budget, but then the council has oversight and, mm-hmm. in theory, could reject what the those entities want. Although in this case, they went along with it, so at least to the degree that they went along with anything. Because this year gets a little tricky. Mm-hmm. According to state law, municipalities have to file their budgets with the state for next year by November 1st. But this year, the city is trying to work out some details of a plan. They're figuring it's going to do some major overhaul of, may bring in additional funds, but there's also going to be some serious cuts that are going to be made. They're trying to stabilize Gary's financial picture. Mm-hmm. And there's no way they're going to know all this by November 1st. So basically, they went ahead and approved the budget that more or less kept everybody at the same level it was at last year. But the mayor has come right out and said no one's actually going to be getting as much money as has just been approved. And sometime during November and in coming weeks, coming months, the council's going to be watching to see how, pretty much keeping a very strong eye over how much each agency is spending. But they're not going to be going over it. They've been told they're going to be getting cuts, and it's going to be, but we don't know yet exactly how much.
Yeah. So, yeah, apparently it gets the impression that nobody really knows right now. And as you mentioned, a lot of it is because of I guess, how much revenue is coming in. Some of the discussion that you've noted that was made at council meeting, and as well as what's been talked about there at City Hall, is to whether all of the revenue sources are going to be there on hand for 2019?
Well, part of it, too, is they're also trying to go through a plan where they're going to sell off and then lease back their police headquarters in Gary. Mm-hmm. And that plan is still being worked out. And that's supposed to bring in potentially up to $40 million, but they don't know exactly how much they're getting. And part of it is once that is set, then they'll be figuring out the exact how much everybody will have. Mm-hmm. Like I said, this is all pending, and technically they're not going to be done in time for when the state was referred. So they went ahead and approved the budget so that they're in compliance with the state's regulations, with the understanding they're going to be making a lot more amendments than they usually make to the budget every year.
Now, do you get the impression that the state budget agency and the local government agencies that review these budgets in Indianapolis will not necessarily make an exception for the city of Gary, but they realize that they're going to have to be some changes made, so they'll kind of wait and see?
That's pretty much the attitude I'm getting, or the impression I'm getting.
Yeah.
The state would love to see Gary fix it up with its own problems without them having to come on in and deal with it themselves, so they're probably going to be a little more tolerant. But it's something we're going to have to see in coming months, see exactly what happens and if anyone feels the need to get involved. Now, what is actually a bit of an issue is that, you know, there are some officials. There was actually one council member who was very adamantly opposed to what the council, Levita Sparks-Wade. She believes that they should have to be open and honest before November 1st and admit how much less money they're going to have. She actually went so far as to say that all this these maneuverings are an attempt to take money from the state, potentially take money from the state that maybe the city isn't entitled to.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what comes about here when they come back in and bring more figures together. So it's pretty much on Mayor Freeman Wilson's shoulders and the rest of City Hall to try to get all this lined up here, I guess, in time for the council to actually take some action, it appears.
For what it's worth, I mentioned the plan to sell and then lease back the police headquarters building.
Mm-hmm.
The City's Redevelopment Commission, to that end, actually went ahead and retained a firm out of Schererville yesterday, Wednesday night, to properly assess the police building and determine what is its value.
Yeah.
But they didn't get to go ahead and move ahead and proceed with this plan to sell and lease back.
Well, it's one of these stay tuned type moments, I guess, particularly here on the Gary City budget, to be sure. I know one of the other stories that you had on also deals with one of the aspects of the budget that you just mentioned about the airport. In particular, I guess one of the few times that the Chicago City Council even talks about the city of Gary, Indiana, to be sure. In this case, it's talking about the airport and it's talking about the issues surrounding immigration. Tell us what the city council aldermen and city officials are looking at here.
Ed Burke, who is the senior most member of the Chicago City Council, chairman of the Finance Committee, a very powerful player in Chicago municipal government, was lambasting Gary city officials. That's the fact that they allow their airport to be used to assist the federal government in the transportation. It's an embarrassment to Chicago because Chicago actually provides some funding each year to the Gary Airport to help maintain it as part of the overall Chicago area aviation system. And they feel like they should be able to cut off Gary because Gary is embarrassing Chicago on this issue. Now, some people might think that's a little bit of an extreme for some Chicago officials to say, but it is the attitude. There is actually going to be, there are some state legislators in Springfield, Illinois, who are talking about trying to push a measure through that legislature to prohibit Chicago from being able to support Gary mm-hmm. any longer. And there is actually one of the mayoral candidates in Chicago, Gary Chico, who is trying to make an issue of this, trying to claim that Gary is that Chicago shouldn't be helping Gary in and something that has an adverse effect on the growing Latino population.
Now, I also know, too, you had a chance to talk with some of the members of the Gary Chicago International Airport Authority Board about this. What do they seem to think about all this talk that's happening in Chicago about the funding?
Well, the members from Gary are very offended that they're being dragged into this, that they're somehow being placed in the position of being responsible for everything that's wrong with federal immigration policy. Whereas even Chicago members object to what they think is Ed Burke trying to play politics with this issue. It should be noted that Ed Burke's ward in the southwest side of Chicago has had some significant population change in the past decade or so. It's actually become his one-time white Irish Polish neighborhood has actually become a majority Mexican neighborhood.
Oh.
And there are those who feel that maybe he's just trying to toss out an issue that he can then claim is his way of saying, I support you. Burke, for his part, says he's merely offended that so many people are being deported, 19,000 plus people being deported to a facility that Chicago is supporting. If you want to believe him on that, then, you know, take his word on it. Your perception, your view.
Mm-hmm. Now, one other story that Greg, you've been able to cover for the Post-Tribune, again, going back to Gary City Hall this time, it's about a very uncomfortable topic, at least for some people, bed bugs. Tell us how bed bugs and City Hall seem to relate together in Gary.
Earlier this month, bed bugs were discovered at the City Hall in the council chambers. It appears they were found crawling all over a man who had come to watch the meeting. Mm-hmm. One of the regulars who usually shows up and likes to express his thoughts in city government. They wound up having him ejected. They removed a few benches. They wound up last week having to spray the council chambers. They brought in the exterminators. And this week, we were told that by the council president, Ron, that as far as they're concerned, the problem's been dealt with.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
The exterminators were in there. They don't think there's a threat anymore. We shouldn't feel threatened to walk into the council chamber.
So apparently there's a clean bill of health, apparently, in this respect for City Hall, in particular, for the council chambers.
Yes.
Are they looking further into this person's carrying the bed bugs? Do we know?
Well, the Gary Health Department did send some people out to the man's home to give him just an overall inspection, what they call a wellness check.
Right.
The idea being, maybe he has other problems, and maybe there's something the city could actually be doing to help him. But as of now, this issue is being considered resolved. The exterminators were in there. These benches that had been removed had been put back. So we'll have to see. You know, if I start scratching and itching a lot, I'll know maybe some bugs remain. I do have to admit that when this incident happened 2 weeks ago, I was actually sitting about three spaces away from the man who supposedly brought the bed bugs into the building to begin with.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, no.
What? In fact, at one point, I had Gary police making sure I hadn't managed to catch on anything. So,
well, that's
although I appear to be safe.
Well, that's good to hear. We've been talking with Greg Tejeda, who covers news from city government for the city of Gary and other affairs too for the Post Tribune. And as always, Greg, thank you for spending some time with us to tell us about the stories that you had out there in print and online recently.
Thank you.
This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and let's turn now to Joe Pete, who covers business affairs for the Times of Northwest Indiana, for the stories that he's had in print and online lately. And Joseph, it sounds like that some of the major stories that you've been covering deal with the steel industry here in Northwest Indiana. Bring us up to date first on the latest involving the United Steelworkers Union and U.S. Steel Corporation.
Yes. After months and months of negotiation and after the contracts had expired in September, the two sides were fine. And after the workers overwhelmingly voted to authorize a potential strike if needed, the two sides were finally able to reach a tentative agreement. There had been long a dispute mainly over concessions that the company was asking, which the union rejected, since the company is finally profitable. And they take credit for helping restore the company to profitability, partly by accepting a pay freeze for 3 years, then for lobbying extensively for tariffs and helping those get put in place to protect the domestic industry. U.S. Steel and the USW Union have come to a tentative agreement. It still has to be ratified by the 16,000 U.S. Steel employees nationwide, including several thousand locally. The deal would essentially include a 14% pay increase in pay over 4 years. That'd be around 14.7% when you take into account compounding. There'd be a 4% raise the first year plus a $4,000 signing bonus, 3.5% raises in 2019 and 2020, and a 3% raise in 2021. The main sticking points during the negotiations were U.S. Steel was trying to push them to health insurance kind of more in line with some of the private sector right now, where there'd be, you know, very heavy out-of-pocket costs for the workers themselves. The steel union was very concerned about this, since it's a very dangerous job where people can easily get hurt or killed, and they require kind of, you know, pretty good insurance. And the deal would it would preserve the existing health care benefits. It would include a second health care option. U.S. Steel has been trying to kind of push more workers onto the higher premium, higher deductible plans. They're offering like short-term incentives to try and get people to ease people onto that, but there would be the second option in there. But it also preserves the incentive formulas, and it has no premium increases for retirees. So the union was pretty pleased. They did not want to make concessions and argued that, you know, they hadn't really had any substantive raises in they've had no raises at all in 3 years, and they've had only tiny raises in the past 6 years. So and over the same period of time, inflation has gone up, you know, considerably. The company is now highly profitable, and they're happy to share in that. Negotiations, however, are continuing with ArcelorMittal, where it's a lot of the same debates over, over how much workers are going to pay out of their own pockets for their health insurance. And the union is hoping this sends a message to them that the concession shop is closed and that they're not going to accept deep concessions, especially at a time when the domestic steel industry is thriving. And they're asking ArcelorMittal to kind of, strike a similar bargain.
Yeah, I know you mentioned in your stories, in particular the one that you had about the ArcelorMittal situation, that that the Steelworkers Union is taking a different approach in the negotiations with the ArcelorMittal than they did with U.S. Steel, that they made some concessions, that they've agreed to what U.S. Steel wants to do, but they feel that they have to kind of hold the line someplace when it comes to ArcelorMittal as far as concessions are concerned, if I understand it.
Yes. The one of the few concessions in the U.S. Steel one was that previously they'd done 3-year contracts, and U.S. Steel was asking for a longer 6-year contract. Asking for a longer 6-year contract. They met in the middle and agreed to a 4-year contract. But largely they were able to keep, though, the benefits that they had wanted to keep. There were just concerns about their health care being stripped away and that it reducing overall compensation in the case of, like, some workers, and at least definitely cutting into any raises they would get if they're paying thousands of dollars a year out of their own pocket for health care coverage. ArcelorMittal has been making similar demands. They say it's necessary to be competitive in the United States, that they're looking toward the long-term sustainability of the business, and they're trying to get their costs more in line with the mini mills throughout the South, companies like Nucor and Steel Dynamics, and some of those that operate electric arc furnaces and, you know, their operations are nowhere near as big as the huge integrated mills we have here along the lakeshore in Northwest Indiana. But The main disagreements there have also been over the issue of healthcare and of whether the workers of the company should be really paying for that benefit. Historically, it took the union had to really fight to get the good healthcare that it has today, and they're very reluctant and loath to to give that up or to give any ground. A lot of the steelworkers I've talked to, their fears include that if they let the company start charging anything for out of pocket, it's just going to increase every year, and that the company can always claim its costs go up, but their costs go up too.
Do you get the impression, in taking a look at both U.S. Steel and ArcelorMittal, and the talks that have been going on by the union and the companies, that there has to be a pretty tough decisions made in trying to balance things out? That obviously the union doesn't want employees from either company, for that matter, either steelmaker, to suffer for the workers that are on the payroll now, but they have to also think about the retirees as well too. And we know that there are a lot more retirees these days than those people are actually on the payroll now.
Yes, and the retirees have been very concerned because they don't get to vote on the contracts and they don't get to vote in union elections. And it's kind of one of, like, Washington, the District of Columbia, like Washington, D.C., where they're getting well, not really taxation without representation, but they, you know, they put in the work, they secured these benefits for year after year, and they currently have no say in it. So the ongoing fear is that, that as they're trying to reach some kind of agreements, that the current union will then sort of sell out the retirees, and they'll make, you know, cuts to their pension benefits or their health care or that kind of thing to ensure that the current workers are being compensated. However, that hasn't really been happening with this round of negotiations. The union has pretty much been adamant that it's not, because, you know, future workers are going to be retired at some day, so they also have incentive to maintain the retiree benefits. In the case of U.S. Steel, the union says it successfully rebuffed efforts to, you know, start charging bigger premiums to retirees, and it held the line on, you know, existing benefits and, you know, pension benefits for the retirees, and that it was able to help preserve those. But that's been a sticking point. The companies are looking to cut their labor costs wherever they can. In the case of U.S. Steel, I believe they're also getting a new 401k health savings retirement. Health savings retirement benefit that they didn't have previously, but they were able to hold the line on the retiree benefits.
These are tough times, obviously, for both company, apparently, and the union, because of so many issues that come up. And I imagine it, and as we now know that, of course, we're going into the ratification process, at least for U.S. Steel. Does it look like that from the information you see lately that ArcelorMittal may be coming close to coming up with an agreement and another set of ratification votes there?
Well, as far as ratification passing, I've mainly heard favorable feedback. People are mainly happy. The workers were definitely willing to strike. There was a lot of enthusiasm about that, actually. But from the few details that are out about the contract at this point, the workers do seem in favor. It'll be fully explained at the union meetings, everything it does and doesn't include. The bargaining committee is very bullish about it. They're very happy. It was a lot better than what had been previously offered, and preserved some of the benefits that they had wanted to strip away. With ArcelorMittal, it's harder to say. U.S. Steel is pretty much just its U.S. operations. They've had some operations in Canada and Europe, but those have been stripped back over the past couple of years. ArcelorMittal has maybe a little bit more leverage. They're a huge international conglomerate where they have steelmaking and mining operations all over the globe. The U.S. is a big part of that. It is the second largest market in the world for steel, but it is not like their only market. So they're not like entirely dependent on, you know, U.S. steel sales the way U.S. Steel is. U.S. Steel would be far more impacted by a strike. Not to say it wouldn't hurt ArcelorMittal. It definitely would. But it's hard to say how long ArcelorMittal will hold out and how long it'll take them to reach an agreement. Certainly, once there is one more agreement, once there is one agreement in place, there's a little bit more pressure than before to reach it, because the issue is, now if ArcelorMittal workers go on strike, U.S. Steel is poised to come in and take away some of their domestic market share. That could definitely happen and hurt ArcelorMittal in the long term. But it's really hard to say. The company, things had seemed to improve. The union was saying they felt like they were making a little bit more progress. But their last missives to steel workers were that ArcelorMittal was really continuing to push these concessions that it's not willing to accept, especially at a time when the domestic steel industry is thriving. These steel companies have been making hundreds of millions in profit per quarter. The tariffs are in place that make foreign steel 25% more expensive. They're really unwilling to make concessions, but it's hard to say how soon it's going to take. These negotiations often will stretch out far longer than during the last run. They went months and months past the original deadline. I think they went into the next year even, and there were multiple rallies, and so it could be a prolonged affair like that. It's really too early to say.
And we'll just have to wait to see it. As far as ArcelorMittal is concerned, we know, of course, as we mentioned, how U.S. Steel turned out here. And Joe P., thank you very much for spending time with us to go over all this, and we'll look forward to the updates here as far as ArcelorMittal is concerned and the U.S. Steelworkers Union.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Joe Pete is the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. This is Regionally Speaking. This is Ball State University's centennial year, and the university, based in Muncie, is taking the celebration on the road. They're working with United Way of Porter County to help support literacy and the cycle of generational poverty, and it's all through early childhood education. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson had a chance to talk with Delana Boyd. She's the Associate Vice President for Community Engagement at Ball State about this topic and how it relates to the Valpo Half Marathon and 5K that's coming up in Porter County on Sunday.
So I understand that Ball State is working in conjunction with United Way of Porter County, and you are celebrating your centennial and also promoting literacy for kids?
Yes, we are celebrating. This is our centennial year, celebrating 100 years at Ball State. We kicked off with some celebrations here on campus, and now we're taking what we're calling the centennial celebration on the road. And we'll be bringing a birthday party to town in essence with balloons and cupcakes and Ball State giveaways. One of the things that we like to do as we stay true to our values in being socially responsible is connect to issues or priorities in local communities, and one of those is a connection to literacy. So in addition to the fun that we bring, we're also asking for people to help us put together literacy kits. So at the end of the event, we not only will have shared more information about Ball State, but also encouraged people to help us put together 250 literacy kits that will be left behind for the United Way of Porter County to distribute throughout the community as they feel necessary.
What is going in these kits? I'm assuming books and...
Just a children's book and then a craft project that the parent or the caregiver can work with the child to put together. The book itself has a theme about flying, and so we'll put enough pieces and parts in the kit that the parent and child or the caregiver and the child can put together a kite that will commemorate, and they can discuss the book, and it has the Ball State logo on the front of the kite.
And why are you doing this? Why is Ball State doing this?
I think it's important for folks to know more about the university and to involve the state and our alumni in the celebration. We're celebrating, people are saying we're celebrating a proud past and a bright future. So it's good to look back and to know that we've grown and that we've built on our foundation as a teacher's college, but now have become a world-class university. So we're sharing more about our university as we travel across the state, but in many ways having an opportunity for our alumni to reconnect with us as well.
What are you most famous for? What is Ball State most famous for, besides the fact that, didn't David Letterman go there?
David Letterman is it. We are. He is a proud alumni of our institution. But I think as you look, our roots, our first endeavor into higher education was that of a teacher's college. And so I would think that in most cases we are very well known for that, but we have a number of recognized programs. Our College of Architecture and Planning is also well recognized throughout the state.
Since Lakeshore Public Radio predominantly covers Northwest Indiana, would you happen to know how much of your student population is from Northwest Indiana?
Oh, gosh, Sharon, I'm sorry. I don't have that statistic off the top of my head.
Do you happen to know if there's students there from Valparaiso, Gary, Merrillville, Schererville, Hobart? Do you know any of those towns?
I recognize the towns. I don't have the numbers. I understand, though, that we have students from all counties in the state, all states in the union, and I don't know the number of countries across the world, but I do feel that we've easily covered every county in the state.
Awesome. So how can people help you in putting these literacy kits together? Do you need donations of materials, or do you need people to actually, do you already have the materials and you're going to put the stuff together?
We have the materials, and what we need are our hands to help us assemble the kit. And I think if anyone's willing to come out and help volunteer as a part of the half marathon and the 5K, they are still looking for volunteers to help with that. But while they're there, they can also spend some time helping us put those literacy kits together. We'll bring all the pieces and parts. We just need bodies to help us with the assembly.
And where and when is this going to happen?
The event is on October 21st. And right after the race, right after the runners finish the race, we will be set up with the cupcakes and our booth and ready to put the literacy kits together. So my understanding is that the half marathon starts at 8:30. The 5K starts shortly before 9, and they estimate the first runners will come across the finish line around 9:15, and the half marathoners sometime a little after 10.
What do you think that Ball State wants to get out of doing this work?
I think it's an opportunity for us to share more about the institution. I think it's an opportunity for us to give back to those local communities where our alumni are, and hopefully it's a way for our alumni to reconnect with the institution.
Is there anything else that you wanted to mention that maybe I haven't asked you about?
The only thing I would say is that they're still looking for runners for the race. And looking for volunteers as well. So anything that we can do to help spread the word, to help connect and help enhance the work of the United Way, we sure would appreciate that. The information about the race can be found at unitedwaypc.org.
That's Elena Boyd, who's an Associate Vice President for Community Engagement with Ball State University, talking with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. If you've been down the beer aisle lately, you probably noticed the growing number of barrel-aged beers. The popularity of the drinks shows there's been more demand for used barrels these days. And as Barbara Brozier tells us, it's creating new business opportunities for distilleries, and it's turning an underground industry mainstream.
As you step into Upland Brewing Company's wood shop in Bloomington, it quickly becomes clear where the building got its name. Upland President Pete Batuli stands toward the back end of the shop, where wooden wine barrels line the walls from floor to ceiling.
A lot of our growth the last couple of years has come from our sour program and barrel-aged beers.
Upland opened the wood shop 2 years ago to help support its growing sour ales program. Unlike other styles of beer, brewers purposely introduced wild yeast or bacteria during the fermentation process. That's what gives sours their tangy flavor. And wooden barrels are an essential component. Upland formed a partnership with Oliver Winery more than a decade ago, trading a few cases of beer for a few wine barrels. Batuli says they use them as fermentation vessels.
So the microorganisms live inside the wood, and we need the barrels to really be kind of neutral. We don't want a ton of flavor. We just need a vessel for this really amazing fermentation.
But you can also find some barrels at Upland's production facility, where it brews its clean or non-sour beers. Zach Allgood is the head brewer here. He uses spirit barrels to add unique flavors to certain brews. Bourbon barrels are most common, but he even has beer aging in a couple of peated scotch barrels.
Typically, spirit barrels, the alcohol content is high enough that there's nothing in there that can contaminate the beer. And we will just fill those barrels with fermented beer and let it sit, typically 6 months to a year. And after about 6 months, we'll start tasting them, seeing where they are and making the decision on whether these beers are done yet or whether they need more time to mellow out.
In addition to Oliver, Upland has a good relationship with a few Kentucky distillers. So oftentimes, getting a barrel is as easy as making a phone call. But they can be much harder to find for breweries that don't have those relationships.
It's like becoming a detective to try and find it.
That's Noah Steingraber. He's in charge of national and international craft sales for Kentucky Bourbon Barrel in Louisville. He fields a lot of calls from brewers around the world looking for specific barrels. It's his job to track them down using his network of contacts. When they first arrive, coopers inspect them. Then they make any necessary repairs. A job that requires great skill and strength. The coopers work in the middle of a giant warehouse, replacing the wooden staves or metal hoops on the barrels. While most of the barrels they repair held bourbon or whiskey, Steingraber says brewers are increasingly on the hunt for more unique vessels.
So it's interesting to see how it's continued to evolve, not just from bourbon, but into other barrels such as wine, rum, tequila, maple syrup, hot sauce, you know, there's so many different things out there.
The cost of buying barrels can add up quickly, with some running well into the hundreds of dollars. Like with most businesses, it's cheaper to buy the barrels in bulk, but many brewers don't have the necessary capital or the storage space. That's creating an opportunity for more regional and local partnerships between beverage makers. Hotel Tango in Indianapolis makes several different spirits, including bourbon and whiskey. Founder and CEO Travis Barnes says they recently started partnering with local breweries.
We learned early on that, one, we didn't have a very big marketing or advertising budget, and this was an easy way and an effective way to get our name out among folks that wouldn't necessarily have ever heard of us.
The distillery is getting an increasing number of requests for its used barrels, and while acting as a broker isn't something master distiller Eric Stauffer says they initially planned for, it's mutually beneficial.
We'll provide them with some of our bourbon barrels for use in aging things like porters or stouts or IPAs, and then on the backside, we will then get some of those new barrels back and age some of our bourbons. We'll finish them than in some of the porters or the stouts barrels that we would get from the breweries.
It's an opportunity he expects more distillers will start raising their glasses to. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
That's it for Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday. And for this week, thanks for joining us. I'm Chris Nolte. And our thanks as well to Doug Ross and Joseph Pete with the Times of Northwest Indiana and Greg Tejeda from the Post Tribune and to Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson for their contributions. We'll be back with you on Monday.